That's why ghosts are spiteful and why they terrorize people with their mere presence. They're full of regret or disdain for the sickness or elevator shaft or fire that got them, and they can't stand that the world goes on. Sure, it's depressing when they die, but after a few months, that's all you really need to know about them, because the rest is history. I wonder if ghosts are scared of ghosts.
It's the COI Podcast.
Hello from Brooklyn. I'm Sergey Burbank, Coordinating Director of Conflict of Interest Theater Company. The COI Podcast combines a love of literature with a love of performance, and for the next few episodes, we'll show that love even more than before as we present live recordings of the COI Podcast presented before an audience. In the summer of 2010, the COI Podcast presented live recording sessions over the course of four evenings as part of the Bococa Arts Festival at the Archip Gallery Theater in Brooklyn. We've never recorded the podcast outside the COI Podcast Central, so this was an experiment. You'll notice some rough aspects to the audio, everything from creaking chairs, echoing voices, and street-level traffic. Our performers and audiences rolled with it and had a great time. I invite you to do the same for the same effect. Kyla Hertz, a native of Park Slope, Brooklyn, has been writing personal essays passionately for a year and was recently awarded a gold key for a portfolio she submitted to Scholastic. Hertz has begun studies at Bates College this year. Her original works, Passower and The Boy from the Mountain Movie, were recorded during our opening night program.
The strong Czechoslovak accent has a V and W trade-off. I vazande wan vik express vay, and this total moron started honking at me, like some moron. Why are you honking on an express vay? Great aunt, Sylvia. Why you don't call me sweetheart? You don't allow me? I wish you would call me cookie. Great aunt, Hella. I made your favorite mashed potatoes and spinach and steam vegetables. It is so good, I'm telling you, it is so good. Grandmother, Magda, she doesn't complain unless she's standing sideways in front of my full-length mirror when she'll smooth her shirt and say, Kyla, I'm fat. They are the weird sisters of Macbeth. They laugh like tea kettles, they compare how low their eyelids droop, they look younger than they are, they trade their V's with their W's, and they all sit together at my dining room table on Passover. We pass the Haggadah around the table, taking turns reading aloud in either English or Hebrew, and my brother Samson beatboxes during every blessing in between. The sisters judge each other's Anglo eloquence and improvement since last Passover. When Hella mispronounces, smug Sylvia lets the air escape from her lid until it's her turn to say, when Israel saw the great hand which the Lord had wielded against the Egyptians, accentuating, conquering, complacent. Magda, whom we call Batsy since my brother couldn't say Bubby as a baby, focuses so hard that her voice inflects and her pace slows down. They had faith in the Lord and his servant, pause, Moses. And her eyebrows rise in a matter-of-fact sort of way, but it's because she's trying to see the page more clearly through her glasses perched on her nose. Sometimes, Batsy will exaggerate her own accent, like when she tells me, what you talking about? You going to get into all the colleges you love. She will proceed to repeat herself, louder. What you talking about? I'm telling you, every, rolling her R's, single college. And breaks out in hysterics, and we'll continue our conversation in various accents, usually Russian, because my family has had a running Russian joke since they invaded Czechoslovakia in 1968. My parents also picked up a few languages over the years, so when they work out a cab tip in Polish, the driver will ask, oh, are you guys Russian? Which clearly offends my mother. It's all very confusing. Hella's accent, like her husband Andy's, has random traces of Hungarian, which include wrong syllable emphases. Andy will say, don't be embarrassed. Take another slice. So Hella trades her V's and W's and emphasizes the wrong syllables at the wrong times. A generation below the sisters are dwindling accents of my parents, Joseph and Ivana. My father never really had a real one, but he did have a speech impediment as a kid, where he let the ch sound escape from only one side of his mouth. My brother Samson and I used to beg, "Say where you lived as a kid in the way you used to say it," never giving away the location. And he would say, "Brighton Beach," with the side ch, and we would almost literally explode into laughter. He's from Beersheba, yet there's no trace of an Israeli accent. He will, however, overpronounce the O in mentioning his age and say, 48 is almost halfway to 100, in a Brooklyn sort of way, and disregard the A in metal and say, metal, in a Yiddish sort of way. My mother's accent used to be more prominent, but now the jokes lie in her grammatical choices. We went with Abba to the Prospect Park. She includes we, even though she's only referring to herself and my father, so it's redundant, and she'll add the before prospect. She also says, in a middle of nowhere. And on Passover, she'll single herself out of the lack of accent competition and won't look up from her Haggadah after the paragraph is through, as if she's not wondering if the sisters are impressed, even though I saw her heart pound through her shirt as she studied her lines beforehand. And I'm one of the four American observers. There's my brother and my cousins, Charles and Benji, who are the sons of Sylvia but are young and American, so they're in our section. The boys and I lock eyes during the trade-offs, inflections, and emphases. My brother and I are as courteous as possible, but Benji laughs uncontrollably, and Charles patronizes Sylvia. "Ma, why'd you name me Charles? You can't even pronounce it, Ma." She'll laugh and say, "I wanted a name that sounds like Chaim, and all I could think of was Charles. Like Prince Charles. You my prince." The conversations are repetitive, but haven't yet been wrung dry. My grandfather Abe poses his same theory disproving evolution, which gets more than enough of us heated, so he'll start to tell his joke about the Pope driving the limousine, which I'll finish before he's done, followed by his Alzheimer's joke, strategically placed after the Pope joke because he repeats it all the time, and the fact that 75% of my family was born in October will somehow find its way in. And Sylvia will talk about her bargains at Bloomingdale's, and Charles will mimic, "Back in Porubka, we didn't have Marshalls." At the end of the night, my father sits alone, banging on the Seder table while he benches. The matzah crumbs jump, and Samson chimes in from the couch where he has a pillow over his head and a pant button undone. Sylvia and Hella are pulling their eyelids up in a hand mirror. Benji checks his phone as he pours his ninth glass of wine, murmuring along incoherently. Charles says, "Ben, you're being disrespectful, Ben," even though he's doing the same. Magda and Ivana are cleaning the dishes and picking at leftovers. Everyone is humming, "Chad Gad Ya," tapping on a dish or couch frame or a knee because my father's voice is bellowing in every corner of the apartment. I don't know what it is about me that makes people comfortable enough to tell me things. Best friends, sure, no big deal. But then there are the ones who drink three shots of rum and go rummaging through the crowd at brownstone house parties, fumbling through the skinny hallways, desperately searching for someone to entrust with their secrets. I found that on many occasions, they found me. When I went to Israel last summer, I met a boy named Devin on a coach bus. The first time we talked, we were on our way to a museum or hiking spot, I can't remember which, and he was sitting in the seat right across from mine. We each had our own row. His shirt was a tan-colored souvenir from a bluegrass festival, and in dire need of a friend, I pretended that I'd wanted to go. Oh my God, I'd wanted to go to that so bad. "You like bluegrass?" he asked me, suspiciously. He was from Austin, Texas. Of course he liked bluegrass. He had huge, light brown eyes and a pouty mouth, and he spoke so delicately that I felt like the power of the yelling voices a few rows back would make him shatter into pieces right there in his bus seat. "Yeah, love it," I said, with the slightest hint of nonchalance. Okay, so the only name I recognized on his shirt was Connor Oberst from Connor Oberst and the Mystic Valley Band, because he's also an acclaimed emotional musician that I was well acquainted with in the eighth grade. "I can't believe you went," I said from across the seat. I warned before moving to the spot right next to his, so I didn't seem like I was trying to act stealthily suave. We had more in common than our love, or fake love, for bluegrass. We were photographers, we had freckles, and we both spoke with a sort of girlish tone. After the program ended, Devin and I stayed for a week-long extension on a kibbutz with kibbutzniks, and our bus of 45 turned into a bus of 12 or so. On our first day of our stay at Netzer Sereni, we jumped into their pool together. I came up for air before he did, so I got to see him shake his head and get the water off of his face and rub his bug eyes with fingertips. You look like Jake Gyllenhaal right now, I confessed. Who's that? You know who he is. If you saw him, you'd definitely recognize him. Is he cute? He batted his long black eyelashes. Well, yeah, but you only look like him when you're wet. I noticed at the Dead Sea, but I didn't say so because I wasn't sure yet. I did a handstand. And then Jana Heaton, who went to school with Devin, explained that Jake Gyllenhaal is that gay one from the Mountain movie. Brokeback Mountain. He's not really gay, though. I corrected both assumptions in reverse order. Then Devin told me something weird. Well, weird to me, I guess. Wouldn't know, not allowed to see it. He began to float on his back. I sort of stared into his face for a while and clenched my nose to make sure nothing was coming out of it. I smoothed my hair back and I asked, "Your parents won't let you?" "'Cause it's gay," he casually confirmed and submerged his whole body underwater. When Jana told me on the second night of our stay in Israel that she was here with her friend Devin, I asked if they were a couple, obviously, and she laughed. "No, I'm pretty sure he's totally gay. Shame though, he's cute as hell, right?" "Come on, Miss Brooklyn," Devin chuckled. "I'm from Texas. What did you expect?" I don't know what I expected. I was upset and confused. Did Dr. and Mrs. Schultz shield Devin eyes from the scripted sodomy because they were Texan? No, no. Because Brokeback Mountain is irreligious? Well, no. Because as parents, they knew their son was gay and maybe he would see a part of himself in Jake Gyllenhaal like I did. Days later, the rum kicked in and Devin clumsily felt his way through the paths of Netzer Sereni holding a big red cup, and his beautiful eyes were squinted and his feet were sticking so far from the front of his Adidas slippers that his toes were walking on the earth and his heels on the black plastic. Ka-a-a-ayla, he had found me. It was the last night of our trip, and the kibbutzniks were throwing us a party in our honor. Gil and Itamar were blowing hookah smoke into the faces of kibbutz cats, and Carmel and Gali were dancing barefoot together on the red ground to the faint, fast music playing in their clubhouse. Devin was walking towards me with his finger planted on his bottom lip and his hand on his hip. Halfway to the point where I was standing, he began to run. I stood with my hands at my sides, closing my eyes tightly, anticipating his body weight on mine. When I opened my eyes, I was on the ground under him, and his nose was touching mine. He wanted to tell me something, because I was Miss Brooklyn, and I'd seen and heard it all. Or maybe he just liked me. Or maybe because I'd probably never see him again after the trip, or maybe because I would. I'd be that special random person across the map who knew his secret, and I never tell anyone or the Schultz family because, well, why would I? "You like photography, right?" he asked me rhetorically. I stared at him. "What kind of camera do you use?" I could feel his breath on my cheeks. "I don't know, one of those small Canon ones. I may get a new one for my birthday." "I sometimes like guys." "I always do." He launched himself off of me and threw his back onto the grass. His facial expression didn't change. I could hear his big eyelids shut, and I turned my head towards his to see if I was right. I was. They were. Jana hopped over to our sweaty, limp bodies and melted onto us with her face on Devin's stomach and her chest on mine. "Ready to go home tomorrow?" Her question was muffled, and it sung through Devin's surface. When it reached his core, he sat up quickly, like the reflex reaction you have when the doctor bangs your knee with a gavel, and he said, "Whoa, dizzy," before falling back down. I stared up into the sky, and it was the 100th time I was impressed with the brightness of the stars in Israel, but the first time I actually said, "Jesus, those are bright." One of the stars disappeared, and Jana found composure and peeled herself off of us so she could slither away to the kibbutzniks and Americans trading t-shirts with words in their respective languages as souvenirs on their last night together.
Here's Hertz reading on our closing afternoon, her piece, Eries.
Well, I don't exactly know who I expect to see when I get out of the shower or walk from the kitchen to my bedroom when it's dark. Someone or something that may or may not be alive, someone translucent, Perhaps a little girl with white skin and almond-shaped eyes lacking pupils and irises. Or maybe an old friend. Just some eerie presence. I convinced myself to ride a roller coaster for the first time by thinking, look at how many people just got on and then off. If they choose to, they can forget it ever happened. So I guess that's how I should reason with these eeries in my house or head. My apartment is long, and when the sun has fully set, I flip each light switch as I trek to the living room and flip them in the opposite direction on the way back to my room at the other end. Having a light on won't stop almond eyes, but when I know no one is there, I sleep better. And after I use the bathroom, before retiring safely to my room, I stand there, hands washed, and I wait, because the toilet rumbles a minute post-flushing, and it must stop roaring before I go anywhere, because if my ears aren't fully aware of the surrounding sounds when I leave, a lucid man may take me by surprise. Sometimes the prospect of a ghost can be strangely comforting. Not like bulbous Casper or Alec Baldwin at his prime in Beetlejuice, but someone like Ezra, who's a friend of mine. When I accidentally wake up at 3 a.m, I imagine him at my chair and almost recite my planned inventory of questions about why the hell he did what he did. Sometimes I plan to be mean about it, and sometimes sorrowful to make him feel bad, and sometimes I just act surprised and or excited, like I wasn't expecting him. Mostly I feel conceited for thinking he'd sit on my chair when he could walk through the walls of people who deserve cold sweat paranoia, or his parents who have been acting completely kooky lately. Maybe he even accompanies the two of them on their recent 5 a.m. Prospect Park walks. I loathe ghosts, though. They're completely invasive, perverted, stealthy, heartless, skinless, fleshless, and jealous. Thou shalt not hide inside of someone's coat or in their window reflection because it's rude and a personal space violation. And when you knock on someone's door, you generally let him or her greet you. After all, they are getting up out of bed just to make sure you're not there. So at least be there, right? They can think, but they can't say. A culture in Morocco believes in a parallel universe with jinns, ghostly families that have banks and delicatessens and live the same lives as humans in between our spaces and only interact with one another. I wonder how Ezra feels about living between the spaces of sacks of organs. I'm positive he hates it because now he has to face the flaws without fighting them. He still has to hear about the wars in Israel but can't rally, and he has to watch his family take their crazy walks and his brother Rafi drink simply because he isn't here anymore. Well, tangibly. I wonder if he knows my ring has his Hebrew name carved into it or if he was hovering above the scene where his father ignored me by the food co-op because I'm a motion picture of Ezra's childhood or that I'm scared to talk to Rafi anymore for the same reason. I wonder if I'd be on the list of people Ezra would apologize to if he could because he certainly has one. That's why ghosts are spiteful and why they terrorize people with their mere presence. They're full of regret or disdain for the sickness or elevator shaft or fire that got them, and they can't stand that the world goes on. Sure, it's depressing when they die, but after a few months, that's all you really need to know about them because the rest is history. I wonder if ghosts are scared of ghosts. When my parents used to tell me that the park was dangerous at night, I always asked if murderer, robber, rapist A was scared of murderer, robber, rapist B, C, or D. Why wasn't the park dangerous at night for them? They aren't in heaven and they aren't in hell. So who in God's name are these otherworldly people? Should I even say in God's name? Well, I don't know. It seems that those of us who think about ghosts as wraith-like eeries who rearrange furniture or turn off and on light switches are infantile. And I hate that this belief has such a hold on me. It doesn't satisfy any curiosity of life after death. It just raises more concerns, such as the fact that Ezra wouldn't be in heaven if there were one because, to put it plainly, he killed himself. And he wasn't buried facing the same direction as all the others. Ezra faces east and the rest face north because there must be a distinction. And I feel especially bad because Ezra probably detests being a ghost and detests the others, like how Sartre says, hell is other people or other ghosts. And he's stuck with the ones who actually meant to do it, and now he can't kill himself all over again to escape his ethereality because, well, he isn't real.
The COI podcast is made possible through the generosity of donors to Conflict of Interest Theater Company and is available streaming on the web at conflicttheater.podomatic.com. You can also find us by searching for The COI Podcast in the iTunes podcast directory. Read our blog at conflicttheater.blogspot.com. For more information on the company and its productions, visit us on the web at coitc.org. Graphic design is by Eunice Inquimboy. Legal advice, Paul Renitz. Special thanks to Gamze Ceylon, Ann Galloway, Jennifer Rathbone, Eileen Trilly, Jason Updike, and Sam Van Holgren. Questions, comments, and submissions can be sent to conflictinfo@gmail.com.